Okay, tonight we will be looking at the third in our series of the YSUN, Ladies of the S&P Sephardi Community. And we'll be looking at perhaps the most famous of all of the figures in our series, that being Lady Judith Montefiore. Now, the reason she's most famous is in due and large part because of whom she was married to. Sir Moses Montefiore, perhaps the most influential or impactful in certain ways of Jews in the 19th century. Certainly, probably the most famous, at the very least, of 19th century Jews, known the world over for his philanthropic activities, for his work on behalf of Jews in Israel, for his behalf of really Jews around the world. Who are suffering from anti-Semitism and the like. And so he's a really important figure, and Lady Judith is married to him. And so she's, of course, famous for that. But what we're going to find out tonight is that she is an important figure in her own right. Some of that is because of opportunities perhaps afforded to her by being married to Sir Moses, but that she certainly is a force unto herself as well, and is an important figure to study, certainly when looking at the broader themes that we've been looking at. She fits into those themes. And we had looked in previous weeks about the different challenges that the Jewish community was facing during this time period, right? During the early to mid 19th century. Challenges of conversion, missionary activity, related but slightly different, right? Assimilation that's taking place, and there are, right? There's people that are kind of becoming less connected to the religion. Perhaps as a result of that, that's making them susceptible to conversion, right? Because the opportunities that that presents themselves, the rise of the reform movement, is causing a division within the community. Efforts to achieve full emancipation are taking place, and so there's efforts in the community to lobby and to try to maneuver so that Jews can take the oath of office while maintaining their Jewish identity. A growing challenge throughout the 19th century is the growing number of Jewish immigrants to London, and challenges of poverty within the Jewish community. And all of these kind of issues are happening, you know, around the same time. Some of them are related to one another. Certainly some of them are exasperating some of the other challenges. This is what's happening within the broader community. What we've been looking at is the response, or the responses to these challenges. And what we've seen is that there were some kind of communal responses, some things taking place in the synagogue, or perhaps some of the Jewish leaders that are, you know, playing their role. But you don't see the kinds of literary activities that you find in what you might almost think are similar communities, let's say the German Jewish community, right, at that time, where you find a lot of activity, lots of intellectual activity. You don't find that. You certainly don't find that among the men. But the one thing that you do find, and this actually is different than what you find in, let's say, other places in Western Europe, is that the activity that we do find is actually often the production of these ladies, right? Of these women. And I will state that whether to call them ladies or women seems to be a disagreement between Americans and the English. In England, it seems to be more respectful to refer to them as ladies. In America, that's somewhat pejorative, refer to them as women. But here, using the term women is a bit pejorative. So regardless of who's listening, somebody's going to be aware of that. So we're in England, so I'll use the term ladies. And what we found is that there is quite a number of Sephardic ladies that are taking up the task of addressing some of these challenges, responding to critics of the Jewish community responding to those who advocate reform, responding to the challenges that are in the community with this influx of immigrants, right? And that it's many of the ladies who are taking a role, not something that is entirely unlike what's happening within the Christian world, where ladies are playing that role within English society, right? And so there is a similarity that's taking place during these kind of the end of the Georgian into the Victorian period within England. And so we looked at Abigail Lindo and her contribution towards education, producing Hebrew vocabularies for the children to study. We looked at Grace Aguilar, probably the most kind of important of all of these figures in terms of kind of the breadth and quality of her writings, who wrote on a whole variety of topics, novels and directly about Judaism and poetry, and she wrote in Jewish publications, she wrote in non-Jewish publications, right? So she, you know, kind of is the most significant. And in future weeks, next month, we'll look at Miriam Mendez-Belisario. She writes A Guide to Judaism, Charlotte Montefiore, other figures. We'll look at other figures. Tonight, we're going to look at Lady Judith Montefiore. And what we're going to see is that her personal story plays a role in her particular contributions, right? That it's going to be, her contributions will come, I would say, almost as a result of her personal experiences, her personal life story, which I find to be particularly beautiful, right? That she's going to kind of be driven, or kind of will ultimately, shall we say, make her life make sense, right? That she's going to produce something as a result of all the things that have occurred in her life, and it feels very evolutionary, very very natural, very kind of appropriate, you know, the how she's going to react to kind of her personal life experiences to ultimately produce the things that she does produce. And so in a certain sense, what she's doing is not entirely kind of like, I think this is an important cause, I'm going to go out and do it, but it's very much tied to what happens in her life, right? And there's something very natural about that. Okay, so that's by way of introduction. Does anybody have any questions before we really begin? Okay. So as we begin Lady Judith Montefiore, we're going to look at different parts in her life. We're going to look at her early life, kind of who she is, where she comes from. We'll look at her marriage to Sir Moses, and we'll look at her different activities, broadly speaking. So let's talk a little bit about her early life. She's born in 1784, the daughter of Levi Barnett Cohen and Lydia, can't really pronounce the name, Diemenschleifer, Ashkenazi family. It's actually her father's second wife. He had been married to her sister before she was deceased, if I get the connections correct. And he had children with both of them. Lady Judith is kind of, she was just been Judith at that point, or her Hebrew name Yehudit, kind of finds herself kind of in the middle of those children. Her father had moved to London before she was born, and was an important member of the Ashkenazi synagogue on Duke's Place, just down the road, the Great Synagogue. And they were an important family there, involved in different activities. Not the richest of the families, perhaps, but certainly not a poor family either. And was an important kind of figure in that sense within the community. And kind of fitting that role of kind of where they were, this upper middle class at the very least, Judith was given an education that was appropriate to that place where they were. She was taught many languages, including French and German, Italian and Hebrew. Later on in her life, she'll even get tutoring in Arabic as well. on some of their trips to the Holy Land, as well as an intensive background in literature, in music, in art, right? So really we'll kind of think of this kind of broad education that she's received, a good kind of broad upper middle class English education. Now, where her story is going to become interesting, right, is going to be kind of the development of ultimately what historians now call the cousinhood, okay, which is going to be this combination of marriages between many of the leading families in the Jewish community, where they'll all ultimately somehow be married with each other. And that during this stage, there'll be almost like these series of number of families that collectively are kind of run the major institutions in the Jewish community in England. Yet they're all really one larger family, right? And something that kind of lasts for quite some time, kind of throughout the 19th century. So to kind of paint the picture of what these different marriages are, I'll kind of go through some of them for you. There's others that I'm not going to talk about. I'm going to talk about specifically kind of within these three families, right? So one of the sisters, the older sister of Judith, her name is Hannah. And Hannah is going to marry probably the wealthiest Jew in England, Nathan Mayer Rothschild. Now, this Rothschild is one of the sons of famous Amschel, right, Rothschild, one of the five sons of this important banking family from Germany. He's going to set up the branch of the bank in England, and he will become incredibly well-to-do. She will marry this into this Rothschild family. That will happen in 1806. Okay, that's when that marriage happens. Now, in 1812, her sister, Judith, is going to marry Moses Montefiore, okay? And so they'll have that. But then in 1815, the brother of Sir Moses, Abraham Montefiore, is going to marry the sister of Nathan Rothschild, Henrietta, okay? So Rothschild and Montefiore are married to the Cohen sisters, and one of Montefiore's brothers is going to marry the sister of Nathan, okay? So there's all of these kind of like connections between these different families going on, right? So basically, Montefiore and Rothschild will both be married to the same sister, but there'll also be a Montefiore and a Rothschild that are married directly to one another as well. As a result of these connections, there is going to be a degree of collaboration between these families, particularly within the realm of business. Montefiore is a broker, the Rothschilds are bankers, Montefiore will play a role in facilitating many of the deals the Rothschilds are involved with. He'll make a lot of money as a result of that because you get a certain percentage, and he will become incredibly wealthy and famously retires at the age of 40 and devotes the majority of his efforts at that point to philanthropic causes, though he does continue to kind of have his seat on certain boards and continues to kind of be involved in some business, but he's no longer kind of actively involved in kind of the business that he had been before he retires. And so you have all these families connected. They're very well off, and they kind of are the kind of the elite of the Jewish community, right? England is very classist, and they are kind of the elite of the Jewish community, right? What becomes known as this cousinhood of these different families that are together. It doesn't mean there aren't tensions, there's business tensions. Apparently Abraham Montefiore is not as successful in his business. That puts strains on the Rothschild family. The Rothschild family in continental Europe is not necessarily so happy that the Rothschilds are getting, in a sense, into bed with other families. They kind of want to keep it all within just the Rothschild family. So there'll be those types of challenges that will happen. Ultimately, there'll be other challenges because there'll be splits. If you're part of the family will go and help found the reform movement in England, and that will cause strain within the family as well because Moses Montefiore is a staunch traditionalist. And so it's not that it's all sweet and easy, right? There's definitely going to be tension and challenges within the family as a result of other factors, but ultimately this is part of one kind of bigger family, right? And so that places a little bit kind of who Lady Judith is, kind of the family that she's part of, and about these different kinds of connections, right? So she's not just some, you know, middle-aged person that Moses has picked up and she's just because of him, right? She's part of this, you know, her sister has married a Rothbaum, she's married a Montefiore, right? They're part of this kind of, this elitist segment of the community. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about her. And I have some different sources here. This is a younger portrait of Lady Judith. And here I'm gonna just read to you something that her mother writes in her will to her. Her mother will die in 1818, right? So Lady Judith is married in 1812. Maybe we'll just put some of these up on the board, right? So let's do right over here, right? So we have Lady Judith, right, Cohen, then Montefiore. Right, she's born in 1786. Right, and she marries in 1812. Right, so born. Sorry, I think it's 1784. 1784 and 1812. She marries. 1818. Just to kind of add this, we'll add other dates. Right, is when her mother passes. Her father has already passed before this time. Okay, and so let's just see over here. This is from the will that her mother leaves for her. And she writes the following. She says, "I beg and pray for you not to forget that you are Jews and keep your religion and to always have in your memory your father who is in heaven and take example from him." Right? So this is a message she's receiving from her mother the year before her mother actually passes, right? About the importance of never forgetting that they are Jewish, keeping the religion. Right? And this message is relevant because we know there are people who have left the community, right? We've learned about the Disraelis, right? There are other families as well, Goldsmiths and so on, that have had people that have adopted Church of England, right? Have left the community, right? So this isn't just kind of this, oh, you know, stay connected. It's a real message to her daughter about maintaining her sense of Jewish identity. And even while though there are other people in their social class that are now leaving the community to say that, no, you should maintain your allegiance to the Jewish community, okay? And so that's a message that's very powerful, right? That's kind of one of the last messages, right, that she's getting from her parents. But let's take a look at some other things, because she ends up, they marry in 1812, and they go on honeymoon, right? So here's an early miniature of Moses and Judith. So you can see this, right? This is when they're young. And she writes the following, right? She writes a little bit about their early time together. She says, this is the opening entry. It's one of the few things we have of the Montefiores. A lot of their writings were burnt upon the death of Sir Moses. Professor Lowy, who was the secretary of Sir Moses at his death, burnt most of the writings and letters and things that of Sir Moses' collection. There's different opinions about what exactly happened. Why did Sir Moses ask him to? Was there something in there he didn't want him to find out? I guess we don't have a lot of their original writings. We have diary that this Professor Lowy transcribed of theirs, right? So it's perhaps an accurate representation, but we do have a few things that they did, particularly from Lady Judith. We have her honeymoon diary, and we also have one of her travel diaries, okay? The honeymoon diary was not published. It was something that was found later, and she writes the following. She says, "I was this day united in holy bonds of matrimony to Moses Montefiore, whose fraternal and filial affection gained in me an interest and solicitude in his welfare at a very early period of my acquaintance with him, which joined to many other good qualities and attention towards me, ripened into more ardent sentiment." Right, so you get the sense from this very flowery description that when they first met or married perhaps, or when they first kind of were meeting, there was a sense of kind of you know, get on with it. You guys should marry. But with actually getting to know him, that she actually felt a large amount of affection for him. And as we'll see, this was shared by Sir Moses as well. But one of the things that she describes about him, I think, is quite telling, because it says, following, she goes, I did not know any circumstances more pleasing to me than to perceive that my dear Monty, as it's called Monty, right, is religiously inclined. It is that sort of religion which he possesses that, in my opinion, is most essential, a fellow feeling and benevolence. Okay? And so one of the things that she really values in Sir Moses is his religiosity. What's interesting from here, and we'll talk about this, is what when she refers to him as religious, what does she mean? What does it mean when she's saying that he's religious?
Well, nothing is particularly.
Well, from what she says, from what she writes. Don't say from what.
But he has some spiritual feeling.
You're saying spirituality.
Yeah,
I think it's what Andrea says, right? It's that he's a good person, right? What it is that sort of religion which he possesses that, in my opinion, is most essential. What religion does he possess? A fellow feeling and benevolence. Right? She's not saying the fact that he's, scrupulous in his religious observance. She's telling you what religion means. Religion, in this instance, she's defining as that he's nice to other people. Right? Is that what you see there? Yeah, right? So that's what she means when she says that he's religious, right? So perhaps he has good midot, right? He's living according to the Jewish ethic, right? And she sees that. That's something that she's so pleased that he has those qualities within him, right? And so that's something which is really, very touching, right? That's something that she really values. And it almost sounds like she's almost like, didn't know that was going to be there. Right when they got together, and is feels fortunate that it turns out that he does have that. Perhaps what it does also intimate is that he has that type of religion and not the other type, right? He has the type of religion of being kind to others, but he doesn't have the other things that we define of his religion, which maybe is kind of the ritual scruples as well. And we'll see that probably actually is the case from things we know. In fact, we know from other descriptions in her diary that it seems that they went places and they described eating meat and drinking wine in places that where it was not kosher. And so it seems that at this stage in their life, they are not particularly orthodox in their religious observances, but they are dedicated to each other. They're dedicated to the ethos of Judaism, and she describes it on their honeymoon. They stop in different towns, and he goes to synagogue in these places in continental Europe. And so he's very much connected with his Jewish identity and his active participant in the Jewish community, even if they're not particularly orthodox, if we could use that term, at this stage in history, observance of the kind of the ritualistic side of Judaism. Okay. But we know that piety is something which is important to them, and that's something that will develop over time, and we can actually see that in some of the other writings. So we'll get to some of these other texts in a moment. But what we will see, and this is something that will come out, is that this notion of piety is important to her, right? Being religious, again, regardless of how you define it, is something that she feels very strongly. It's kind of her upbringing. It's the message of her mother. She talks about it as some of the very first things that she described in her relationship to Monty, right, to Sir Moses. At this point, just Moses, not Sir Moses yet. And that this is something that she feels very keen, right? She's a deeply kind of religious lady. However we define what religious means for her. Now, one of the things that's going to play out, and we'll see this in some of the other sources, is that they do not have children. They never have any children together, and that will certainly play a role, I think, in their lives, and probably in the way they devote their lives to philanthropic causes, right? They don't have their own children, and so perhaps that inspires them to think about others, which maybe if they had had children, they would have just thought more about their own family, right? So there's kind of this real focus on, you know, what they can do for the broader world, for the broader Jewish community, for the local community, for the Israel community, that they will devote themselves to. And I imagine part of that is driven from their childlessness, and we'll see how that actually does play a role in some of their interactions as well. Yes. I don't know. Good enough. They don't kind of have that scientific knowledge back then, so who knows? Who knows exactly why? Yeah, it doesn't seem like it was intentional, you know, that they didn't have children.
Was 28 quite old to get married for a woman then?
I don't know. I'm not sure. It would seem to me like it would be a little bit, but I don't know.
How old was he when she got married?
Yeah, I think they were about the same age, weren't they? Yeah, they're the same age, yeah. An age-appropriate marriage.
Actually, for Thursday, is she going to marry at 38?
Yeah, perhaps. But one thing that we do see that comes out, and we'll see this in some of the other quotes that I've pulled here, is we see that he really saw her as his partner. And he attributes a lot of his success to her. There's a high degree of affection, he lives to the age of 100. You know, she dies in 1862, right? And so there's definitely, she dies much before he does. And he seems to really be distraught by her passing and kind of mourns for her for the rest of his life. I didn't pull all the quotes, but you see lovely things he says earlier in their life. And later, there definitely he has a high regard for her. And so we'll see some of those things. But any other questions? Yes.
Yeah, was it arranged marriage between Moses and...
I mean, they live in the same town. They probably knew each other. So I don't know in that sense if it's completely arranged, but on some level, yes, as well. I'm sure it was considered to be a suitable pairing because of their other connections and things like that. But I don't know that it was necessarily, it doesn't seem that it was a blind marriage either, right? She describes that they got to know each other as well. Yeah.
Well, wasn't it quite unusual for a wealthy Sephardi to marry an Ashkenazi?
So it's something which is increasingly happening, yeah. Right? Meaning, for example, his brother will marry a Rothschild as well. So it's starting to happen. It's something that's happening in the community, that there is a blending. For example, the Reform Synagogue that will open will refer to itself as, you know, the new synagogue of Britons or something like that, and it's made up of Ashkenazim and Sephardim, even though a lot of the service is Sephardic. But there's definitely this kind of melding which is starting to happen in the 19th century, which you don't think of as much in the 18th century, right? So there definitely is that shift that's starting to take place, but it is part of their story, as we shall see. And in fact, I'll even mention it now, one of the things that we find is that Sir Moses will create a fund of dowries for people that are, you know, need extra assistance upon their marriage. And the amount that they give, they double if it's a marriage between an Ashkenazi and a Sephardi.
Okay? A Sephardi man and an Ashkenazi woman.
Either. I don't think it matters which way it is, but if it's quote-unquote a mixed marriage, the dower, and they're not well off, the dower they get is double than people who have only married within their Ashkenazi, within their Sephardic communities. So it's definitely part of their, I would say, their identity, right, is the fact that they are this mixed marriage, if we could call it that, between a Sephardi and an Ashkenazi. And it's significant because, it's something that you get the sense was probably, and I don't want to say this with certainty, but you get the sense there was more, in a sense, kind of the sense of, that's a Sephardic community, this is the Ashkenazi community, and certainly in the 18th century, there would have been greater tension surrounding that kind of marriage, and presumably still some tension in the 19th century, which I think means that Sir Moses is doing something which he's almost encouraging it as it were. And perhaps he's encouraging it because it's there's probably some people who are still discouraging that type of union within the community. So I think that's something interesting, and we'll see that. I think that is part of their identity, part of their story, is the fact that they are this Ashkenazi Sephardi marriage. And you see it play out in some of their different activities, as we'll see. But let's talk a little bit about her. Okay, let's talk about Lady Judith. She gets involved in a series of charities. Let me just go down here a little bit. She gets involved in different charities. She was a patron of the Jewish Ladies Loan and Visiting Society. She's an officer of the Jews Orphan Asylum. And she worked towards the education of young girls at the Jews Hospital. Okay? And so she's taking an active role in these different societies. She's playing a role. She's kind of maybe on the board, or she's kind of, you know, playing this prominent role. That's a way you do for fundraising and things like that, kind of putting these people into those positions, not altogether different than you'll find on boards today as well. But we see that she does take an active role, particularly in the education of young girls at the Jews Hospital. And we'll see that will play a role in some of her literary contributions later, is that she is interested in educating these young Jewish girls to be able to become Jewish ladies. And that's something that she cares about and something that she feels is important, particularly with the shall we call it, the lower class or the less privileged of Jewish society, that she kind of plays that role. That's a very kind of like a Victorian type of role, that you're looking at the lower class and you're gonna help them, you know, become the middle class. They might not be your class, but to at least get them to become the middle class, right? And that's kind of your social good that you are doing, right? And there's an interest in doing that, particularly for within the Jewish community. Perhaps again, it was reacting to the fact that there's an increasing number of poor Jews and trying to facilitate their ability to kind of rise in social status and part of the social order of things through those activities. And so she's very involved in different charities. She'll often be invited to take a place on those charities. And it's seen as, and people will write to her. Right? They'll sometimes write directly to her, not to Sir Moses. They'll sometimes asking her to deal with Sir Moses for them, but she will be seen as an important, partner of his, that he is a confidant, that she is a confidant of his, and that people will therefore relate to her directly as a figure, and in a sense, seeing them maybe in almost as equals in a certain sense. Or that at least she has important sway over the activities of her husband. And so she is an important kind of figure in of herself. And we'll see that in some of these other sources. Now, one of the things that we know she does do is she travels with him. She will go on his different travels. Certainly, they go on their honeymoon. They're going to travel around Europe. But then she will go with him on his first trip to Israel, which will happen in 1827, okay? In 1827, and we'll see the following. She writes this in her travel diary, okay? Here you can see an etching of their first trip to Israel. I'll show you the picture, or one of their trips to Israel, I should say, right? So you can see them traveling together, right? She's got her very Victorian hat. And let's see what she says. This is her travel diary of 1827. Now, as I mentioned, her personal diary of the honeymoon was not published, right? But it was found after the passing. But she did write a travel diary, which was published for private circulation, right? So it wasn't something you could go buy in the store. It was something that she had published and then disseminated to essentially whoever she wanted. And she writes the following. She goes, I can never be sufficiently thankful to Almighty God for suffering us to reach this city in safety, referring to arriving in Israel. The obstacles that presented themselves, the dangers with which we were threatened, the detentions and vexations which had actually to be endured. They got stuck for quite some time in Alexandria and Egypt and had difficulties crossing the Mediterranean. All rose in my mind as I gave way to the feeling of delight with which I at length saw the fulfillment of my dear husband's long-cherished wish, right? That it had been his dream to go on pilgrimage to the Holy Land. Nor was my satisfaction a little increased at the recollection that I had strenuously urged him to pursue the journey. even when his own ardor had somewhat abated, and when I had to oppose my counsel to the advice and wishes of our companions. And so, in this entry, she's saying that she actually plays an important role in encouraging Sir Moses to actually go on this journey, despite the different difficulties they had. There were different wars going on. It wasn't an easy journey, but that she kind of played this really encouraging role to get him to go on pilgrimage. And that's what this first trip was. This first trip was pilgrimage. It wasn't him going in order to do philanthropic activities. He's going just because he has the financial ability to do so, and it's this kind of amazing thing. Wow, we're going to go and tour the Holy Land. And that's what he does. They go and they go on tour of the Holy Land. It's going to be an awakening moment for him to see the plight of the Jews in the Holy Land, which will then inspire him to go back six more times during his life. She'll go with him on many of those occasions when she's still living, of course, and to get involved in alleviating the plight. But at this point, it's really just to go and experience the Holy Land. And we see that she kind of takes pleasure in her role and kind of inspiring that activity. But what we see in this other source is that this was a major moment for the Montefiores, because he writes the following in 1827 upon their return. He says, "This day I began a new era. I fully intend to dedicate much more time to the welfare of the poor," right? So he's been inspired by their condition, "and to attend synagogue as regularly as possible on Monday, Thursday, and Saturday." And he seemingly, for the rest of his life, does go to synagogue Monday, Thursday, and Saturday, all the days that we read Torah, right? He goes to synagogue, and we know he's going to live on Park Lane. That is a several-mile walk, right? And he walks it, all right? That's by Hyde Park, right? He's going all across town. He lives very close to Marble Arch, right, to the Marble Arch. So to give a sense of how far that is, he's walking all the way from there to Bevis Marks every Shabbat, okay? He'll have little sympathy for people who in West London say, we need to open up a second synagogue because it's too far, because he walks it every week, right? But he does do that. And so he becomes, at this point, more observant in his religious, right? So he's not only kind of in touch with maybe some of the values and ethics of Judaism, but he's now also going to become more in touch with the rituals of Judaism. And in fact, in future travels, they will go with their own shofet, with their own ritual slaughterer, so that they can have appropriate meals wherever it is that they go. They'll certainly be wealthier in these later trips as well. Perhaps this early trip, they don't have quite the financial standing that they will later on. Like, he's not as wealthy from his young days. He becomes wealthier during his adult life. So they certainly are in a better financial position. We can even see the difference when they describe their early travels, like the kinds of places that they stay and how they're trying to save money, and then the description of later places where it's just like, there's no expense, which is a problem at that point. And so this is a really powerful kind of moment that he experiences, and it was, in a sense, at her encouragement, perhaps. But let's take a little bit other look, because one of the things that she does, she plays an important role also then within their hosting. She will, learn how to, fraternize, and to mix with the elites of Jewish and non-Jewish world, parties, and she'll go with him when he's meeting sultans and kings and czars. Right? She goes to Damascus with him in 1840, to deal with blood libels. They go, I think it's like 1846 or something like that, to talk to the Tsar of Russia because there's been persecutions of Jews in the Pale. And so she's going, she's participating in these trips, and she's kind of this important figure. It's Sir Moses and Lady Judith that will be going together. And as I mentioned, she writes this diary of their trip to Israel, which she will then publish and circulate privately. As it were. And so that's kind of one of her, she's writing throughout her life. That's kind of her first kind of decision to say that, she's written something which other people should be reading, right? That perhaps it can, maybe she's doing it to influence other people, or just maybe amongst their friends and family, that they can kind of experience what she's experienced as she's, writing it and then having it published so that they can have access to that as well. Okay. And here we see just kind of in other depictions that she's always with Sir Moses. Here you can see that this is them on one of their trips, where this is one of the times where he goes in order to take a correct census. The census has actually just been published by the Montefiore Endowment. In order to get a census, what he does when he goes to Israel is he says he will give a charity to every single Jewish person in the Holy Land, but they need to collect it themselves. And so they go to Safed and Jerusalem and so on. They set up shop, and people come in one by one to get their charity, and they're also able to take census numbers, right? And as a result, he meets essentially every Jewish person living in the Holy Land at that time, right? Those thousands of Jews that are already there. And you can see she is right next to him with her giant feather, you know, on her hat, right? So she's there, you know, and it's depicted in the pictures about how they are there together. And in fact, we can see where he really attributes this to her. He says, "I'm no great man. The little good I have accomplished, or rather that I intend to accomplish, I'm indebted for it to my never-to-be-forgotten wife, whose enthusiasm for everything that is noble and whose religiousness sustained me in my career." Right? And this is, he says, after her passing. And we can really see how it is. It's, you know, he really feels that she has been in great inspiration to him, that she has really devoted herself to his causes and has taken up those causes as her own and has pushed him and encouraged him to carry on with his religious activities and with his good deeds. And that perhaps maybe at times he felt tired or wavering, and she, you know, she really kind of pushed him along and said, you know, you need to keep doing this, and he attributes that to her. And again, even in this image of them in Ramsgate, in their home in Ramsgate, again, they're pictured together, right? In so many of the depictions we have of Sir Moses, it is him and Lady Judith. Not all of them, there's some, you know, individual portraits as well. You can look in this room and see, you know, and see a number of them, but in many of these kind of etchings that were taken, it's of them together. Right? And it shows them kind of as this power couple together, really doing things, not just that her doing it kind of in this kind of tag-along type of way, but that she is a really important factor in his activities. Let's take a look at one other thing from their travels, because I think this is important. This is at her passing. There were many poems that were written about them during their travels. They would go, they would come back, and people would write poetry to celebrate their activities. And oftentimes there were even parts of those that specifically speak about Judith. It's not just about Moses. And so this is one from the Jewish Chronicle in 1849, and it says the following. It says, "In Judith, thou of women blessed supreme, thy Lord's right hand with good thine actions teem. Deep in thy heart doth every virtue bide, more than the river's drops that swell the tide. Earth joys thou spurs nest, shadows of a day, thou garnest seeds no waves can wash away." Right? And so beautiful kind of tribute to her, and you know that she is, you know, the Lord's right hand, and she's full of virtue, and you know the things she does cannot be pushed away. Right? And really recognizing that, you know, her activities have independent merit, and that her acts have lasting significance, right? And so it's not just about Sir Moses and his wife, it's Lady Judith, right, as well. Okay, so let's see. I'm going to look at one of the things that she cared about as well, one of the challenges. What we have over here is a rendering based on early, actually, the coloring, I think it was maybe added later. Does anybody know what that is?
Rachel's
tomb in Bethlehem, exactly. Kever Rachel, right? So Rachel's tomb. And she describes that when they went there on that original trip, they went around, maybe Sir Moses went by, and she was brought to Rachel's tomb. Now, Rachel's tomb was a kind of a pilgrimage site, but particularly it was significant as a place that women went to pray for children, right? Famously, that Rachel had difficulty conceiving. Ultimately, she has Joseph and Benjamin, right? But it wasn't something that happened easily, and it became kind of a place that people went for prayer. In fact, the rabbis that were in a sense kind of like the religious authorities over Kever Rachel also wrote a prayer for her, which I'll show you in a moment. But let's just first read her description. And she's very proud of that she's gone there. She says, only 6 European females are said to have visited Palestine in the course of a century. Right? So she is aware that her going to Palestine is not something that's common. It's quite unusual, in fact, for a European female to make this journey in the 19th century. So she's proud that she's done it. And she goes, she's deeply impressed with a feeling of awe and respect, standing as I did in the sepulcher of a mother into Israel, right? Mother in Israel being Rachel, right? And so she is very moved by the fact that she has been able to go to the tomb of Rachel. And in fact, we know that she carries an amulet, as it were, a prayer for her that's produced by one of the rabbis that oversees it, right? You can see his name on the bottom over here, Yosef Nissim Borla, okay? And here you can see this. It's essentially a prayer, right? It says Yehudit Montefiore, and here there's an acrostic which spells out her name, Yehudit, right? And it's describing the waters and so on, right? Water is associated with fertility, probably the mikveh, and so on. And it's some kind of prayer, perhaps, that was written for her, right? That, and we know that when they went to Israel, there would be people that would pray that Lady Judith should be blessed with a child, which, of course, she never was. But that she did seem to feel a deep connection to the tomb of Rachel. In fact, on one of their trips back there, they will decide to have the tomb repaired. Apparently, the dome has fallen into disrepair, and they will rebuild the grain. So that famous picture of Kever Rachel, right, is a result of their improvements to the site. And what's amazing is that when she then passes and they're laid to rest in Ramsgate, Sir Moses will build a mausoleum, right? And that is it, right? It is a copy of the tomb of Rachel, right? And so you can see how kind of meaningful the tomb of Rachel is to them, all right, to her especially, that in fact he lays her to rest. He'll then be buried in there as well. You can go visit it in essentially a copy of the tomb of Rachel, which is really powerful. But let's just take a look at one other text. And we'll look at this in a moment. We'll look at this in a moment. Okay? And so those are a little bit her life, and of course, kind of her activities. But one of the reasons I've chosen to include her in this speech is because she also produced something in writing as well. She produced a diary that was meant for internal circulation, but she did produce a text that was meant for public distribution. And that I have here, and it is called the Jewish Manual. And it is, and we'll see what it is, more than this, but it is a cookbook. It is the first English language Jewish or kosher cookbook that's produced. And it's published, I believe it's in 1849, if I'm correct, in 1849. And what's interesting about it is it says it's written by a lady. It didn't have her name on it. Now, that wasn't uncommon. We've spoken about this in previous lectures, that there was something almost unbecoming of a lady publishing something for fame and glory, right? So while her diary does say it's from her, it was only intended for internal circulation. This, which is meant for public circulation, simply says for a lady, to the extent that when, as many of these Victorian Jewish writings will be forgotten in history, when they are rediscovered, this is rediscovered in the New York Public Library, I think in several decades ago, they don't know who wrote it. It doesn't say her name in there, and they don't know actually who wrote it, and they have to do a lot of research to figure out who, in fact, was the authoress of this book. All it says is a lady. Is that a reference to her because she's Lady Judith? Maybe. But they have to kind of do a little bit of research to figure out who, in fact, has written it. Now, what's interesting about this book is it's written to teach someone how to cook kind of these nicer dishes. And its target is the target which she had worked on in her life. I mentioned that she worked in the hospital, kind of educating young Jewish ladies. And it could be this is kind of her As a result of that, that she's teaching them how to cook and how to care for a home and how to care for themselves, that she then decides to write that and publish it in a book so that it can get wider circulation, right? So it's kind of the culmination of some of her charitable activities. But what's significant about it is that many of the dishes in here may be dishes that were common in Victorian England, but she's, of course, substituting all the ingredients to make them kosher, right? So that they can be eaten by a kosher audience. And I'll just read to you some of the recipes in here that I found to be interesting. For example, we have mock turtle. Half boiled a well-cleaned calf's head, then cut off all the meat in small squares and break the bones, return it to the stew pan with some good stock made of beef and veal, dredge in flour and fried shallot, pepper, parsley, tarragon, a little mushroom ketchup, and so on and so forth. So you can make mock turtle. An important dish, no doubt. Another interesting one, Palestine soup. Perhaps this is a recipe she picked up on their travels. Stew a knuckle of veal and a calf's foot and 1 pound of harissa and a large fowl and 4 quarter in water. Add a piece of fresh lemon peel, 6 Jerusalem artichokes, a bunch of sweet herbs, a little salt, and so on and so forth. One of the things that you find in this cookbook is that it includes both Ashkenazi and Sephardic recipes, which is one of the things the historians looked at when they tried to figure out who the author was, is it needed to be someone who would have been familiar with both kinds of recipes. And of course, she would have been. She grew up in an Ashkenazi home, but then had to cater for her Sephardic husband. And perhaps as a result, came across different recipes, some of Spanish origin, some more of German type of origin. But of course, not only is she substituting recipes to make sure that they're kosher, you even find that within the vegetables as well, that she is careful about the preparation of vegetables. For she writes the following, she says, vegetables should be shaken to get out any insects and laid in water with a little salt, right, to agitate the insects so that you could then wash them off properly, right? So she is sensitive about making sure that there are no bugs within her food, right, to be fit with the kosher laws. And she writes that in here to teach these young ladies how to prepare kosher food. There's other recipes in here like calf's feet jelly, other nine ways known as picha, Ashkenazi Ashkenazi food, and so on. And so there's all these different kinds of recipes in here. They don't necessarily give the exact amounts that you have. I think it'd be really interesting to actually make these recipes. It's one of my ideas of a book, but that's for another time. But she does have interesting recipes in here of the Victorian age. But something else which is in here, which is interesting, is she also then has pieces in here about the toilet, about kind of the personal hygiene and how a lady should care for her skin and her hair and the way and her health and so on. And so she talks about baths and things you can apply to the skin to make it nice. A whole bunch of different kind of techniques that one can have about appropriate dress and not being too showy but being modest. And so that beauty comes not from showing too much but from being dressed appropriately. That's where true beauty comes from. And so very interesting kind of looking at these descriptions. But my favorite quote of the entire book is the final sentence in the book. And I think this really perhaps captures who she was and what she ultimately believed in. Because she writes the following. She says, let those females, therefore, who are the most solicitous about their beauty, right? Women who say, I really want to look beautiful. They really just care about the way they look, and the most eager produce a favorable impression, what should they do to do that? Cultivate the moral, religious, and intellectual attributes. And in this advice consists the recipe for the finest cosmetic in the world, right? And so if you want to be truly beautiful, it's not about the creams that you apply to yourself, right? It's about the moral, religious, and intellectual attributes, which I think is really beautiful, right? That's, her kind of her lingering message after a whole book about how to be in the kitchen, and how to dress and how to take care of yourself. It's ultimately about, the refinement of one's character and mind, which she places the greatest value to them, right? And that's kind of part of what her legacy, and this apparently this book was given out to lots of people and so on, and that was kind of her you know, kind of her most important message perhaps of the book, because that's how she closed it. So of course in some ways it's, you know, saying that the role of the wife is to prepare the food. She probably wasn't doing it herself, she had someone doing it for her. But in her sense of kind of what's ultimately a value is, of course, kind of a person's conduct and values and religious activities and so on, which really define a person to their best. And I think that's, you know, really interesting, again, what it says about, you know, what the elite of the society thought was the ultimate objective of ladies, right? And that's something that we've seen in a lot of these writings, that there is a focus that ladies, the women, right, should be educated, that they should develop their intellect, right? Not things we necessarily think about, you know, in the Jewish community back in the 19th century or whatever, but you see she's part of a collection. And that's why I like this series so much, because we're looking at lots of ladies doing different things, but they're really part, collectively together, they're part of a broader movement. And she is perhaps the highest elite of that movement. And you can see that kind of being imbued within her writings, that she's writing for the lower class, right? So it's part of the objectives of their activities is to raise up the community and to help lead it in a particular direction. And so in that ways, and maybe in conclusion, she is both Victorian and Jewish. She cares about the social good, but also preserves her anonymity, right? As a good Victorian lady shouldn't be seeking personal fame. She's very concerned about refinement. You see that in her writings, and her refinement, how a person should conduct themselves, right? So very Victorian, almost, you know, prudish in that kind of refinement. But she is also religious, right? Deeply religious and committed to her religion and to maintaining religious practices, right? We see kind of all the kosher that being reflected, obviously, in this book. But at the same time, she also has independence, right? And this belief that a lady should have her own ambitions and her own roles and is not simply, you know, an appendage to her husband or simply the mother to their children, right? But has this kind of role that they should play for the broader good as well. And in that way, she probably was a role model for other ladies about kind of the ideal lady. And we know that through all the things people wrote about her, that she was looked up to and was seen as a really important figure and somebody that people should look up to. Does anyone have any questions?
It's interesting to know, so Moses walked all the way from Park Lane to the biggest mosque that morning. Did he walk back or should
he? I believe so. Imagine the summer that would have been. He probably was also out in Ramsgate a lot as well. He built a synagogue in Ramsgate, you know, so that he could always have synagogue there too. And I would say after her death, he then founds the Lady Judith Montefiore College, right, which is meant to train rabbinic scholars, right? And so he's kind of, in her name, is now perpetuating higher Jewish education as well, which I think is, you know, significant too. So I think that, you know, she's an interesting figure. Again, on her own, you might say, oh, she's, you know, this very wealthy Jewish lady. But again, in the context of everything we studied, I think she's a really beautiful example of kind of this ideal that they are trying to present to the broader Jewish community at that time. And so next session we're going to be looking at Mary Mendez Belisario. She does some really interesting particularly religious work, which is really interesting to see coming from a lady. So we'll take a look at that in the next session. That's going to be the 8th of January. And then all the lectures will always be then that, besides that, which will be the second Monday, the rest of them will then be the first Monday in February, the first Monday in March, for the rest of the series as well. So with that, we conclude. I wish everyone a Hanukkah Sameach, and I look forward to seeing you next month. Okay, have a good night.